Clean penetration. No shattered bone. Your heart here. Compression should stop the bleeding.
Who are you people?
Sean. Danny? Danny, I want you to come with me right now, okay? Show me your room.
Now listen to me very carefully.
Dyson listened while the Terminator laid it all down. Skynet. Judgment Day. The history of things to come. It's not every day that you find out you're responsible for 3 billion deaths. He took it pretty well.
I feel like I'm gonna throw up. You're judging me on things I haven't even done yet. How are we supposed to know?
Yeah. Right. How are you supposed to know? Fucking men like you built the hydrogen bomb. Men like you thought it up. You think you're so creative. You know what it's like to really create something, to create a life. Feel it growing inside you. All you know how to create is death and destruction.
Mom! We need to be a little more constructive here, okay? We still have to stop this from happening, don't we?
But I thought, aren't we changing things? I mean, right now, changing the way it goes.
That's right. There's no way I'm going to finish the new processor. Not now. Forget it. I'm out of it. I'll quit Cyberdyne tomorrow.
That's not good enough.
No one must follow your work.
Right. All right, then, we have to destroy all the stuff at the lab, the files, the disk drives, everything. Everything here. Everything. I don't care. The chip. Do you know about the chip?
What chip?
They keep it in a vault at Cyberdyne. It must be from the other one, like you.
The CPU from the first Terminator.
Son of a bitch, I knew it!
They told us not to ask where they got it.
Those lying motherfuckers.
It was scary stuff, radically advanced. I mean, it was smashed, it didn't work, but it gave us ideas, took us in new directions. I mean, things we would have never... All my work was based on it.
It must be destroyed.
Welcome to Dino Movies, and you know that's me, your host, Kyle Bruin. If you've been joining us this season, we've reached season 10, and I wasn't even sure that we would reach season 2 or 3, 4, or 5, but they just kept coming, we just kept doing them, and over the years of doing the podcast, over all the seasons, I've had a variety of guests join me, and I couldn't do the show without them, I couldn't process the analysis without them, you know, the whole idea of the show is to communicate, share, and assess the ideas of the movies that we're processing with other people. And so I couldn't do without them. And so I inversed the idea, the framework, and the intent of the show back to them. And that's what this season's about. Dealer's Choice is about celebrating my guests as individuals. What movies, you know, inspired them? What movies that they would like to bring to the table? And so each and every conversation this season is about a personal choice to my guests. And, you surveying that in the framework that makes it personal to them. And then also, connecting with them with that choice and having a conversation and appreciation for their film choice. And all of them have been fantastic. Some of them are movies I've never seen. Some of them are movies that I needed to revisit. And some of them are just downright classics. And that's one of the movies we're talking about today. I think we need some of those, just filtered in, that some of these substantial blockbusters from our past, these epics, these actioners, these adventures that we constantly were informed on during the earlier parts of our lives, from Star Wars to Back to the Future to Terminator 2. That's the one we're talking about today. All of them have a unique foundation in developing the industry to its largesse today. And so I'm really excited to talk about that one today, because it's set prominently in my own history. But the person who's brought that one to the table today is Bryson Pintard. He is a producer. He's a friend. Been a while, but welcome back to the show, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back.
Great seeing you.
Congrats on 10 seasons.
That's crazy. It's insane. It's insane. I couldn't have predicted it. But it's everyone, you keep coming back. We've talked Heat. talked Heat in the past. Oh my goodness, we did Friday on my first season. Yep. And so it's just been great having, people come in and out of the relations I've had with them and this business, this industry, but just as, sharing it with them. It's been really, heartwarming. And so I want to thank you for being part of that journey.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you for having me. It's always nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have
10
you.
Seasons. That's crazy. So how many seasons a year do you do? Like two?
Now it's two. I used to do three. Jeez. I used to do three a year. I used to do 150 episodes a year. And we stopped doing that after season seven. And so it was almost even too late at that point. It was insane.
You're in syndication now.
We have over 450 episodes. We're on our way to 500.
Holy smokes.
It's just been a journey. And so this has been great. How have you been? It's been a little bit.
It's been interesting. We went through the pandemic, and that ultimately changed the industry forever.
Yeah.
Might have been the stab in the back to kind of send it down this dark path that we're currently in.
Sure.
We found a way to kind of survive and work through that. And it was actually pretty busy for a lot of filmmakers, I think, during that time period. After a certain, down period, it got really busy. And then, with the strikes and whatnot, it's been really hard. And I think we've kind of seen a really ugly, dark side that, everyone's kind of this is what happens every now and then. But we're kind of seeing some major players exit the business. We're seeing, it's always the things that nobody really cares about, the prop houses and, these legendary talents that work below the line for years and years. They've had enough of this. And so they're kind of just exiting the industry and not really passing on their skills to any apprentices. Or there's a major kind of gap between the old guard and this new guard and, the kids coming up and whatever. So you're kind of seeing a lot of these talents kind of just fade away into oblivion. You're seeing a lot of lost relics go up in smoke with Sony going down. Faux libraries on the verge of collapse.
Yeah.
You always hear the rumors about Warner Brothers getting bought out. And then if that happens, they'll probably cut out their property house, which is literally priceless.
Jesus.
You walk through there, it's like a museum.
Yeah.
Every day, it's something. It seems like it's more and more bad news. So you're kind of hoping that there's going to be a big rainbow at the end of it.
You hope that maybe there will be a shift, right? Of course, a shift, this pendulum shift that will seek out and appreciate where things have been built upon and where they have come from. But it's painting a very dreary picture, but a very accurate.
It's true. And I think it's important to acknowledge it. And again, I feel, apologies to the viewers. It's not going to be a whole downer episode, but it is important to kind of recognize where we are and do appreciate these moments in history and what these films have done for us and all the different elements that make up a film.
Yes.
Which I think is a good segue into Terminator.
I very much so. I mean, Terminator is one of the grand, I think the grand operatic displays of what everything in the industry it's goes so good. Into. It's, yeah. It's practical stunt work and effects. It's mixed with the enhancements of CGI. It's got characterization. It's got real set design and real location filming. All of that is what makes it so enthralling, so thrilling. If we start losing the practicalities, mm-hmm. we start losing physical sets, if we start depending on it in just polished, pretty much frictionless digital environments,
totally.
We're going to lose so much.
Totally. It's like, it's pretty much, I mean, it's one of my favorite movies. I think I picked this movie probably a couple of years ago.
I sent out feelers for this because I was like, I'm curious what people will pick. And then I'm trying to design seasons around the choices. Like, am I going to have that pick in a later season or am I going to, sure. I put out feelers of this time ago.
And here we are years later.
sitting down to do it.
But it's such a good movie. It's just so well done. I think to me it's kind of like the pinnacle of filmmaking. Like all of like the talents and like the biggest the industry ever was kind of came to like a point at right there. You had, you know, what was it? Guns N' Roses, right? Was like, did a music video.
For
whatever that song was.
Yeah, I forget it, but it was on the Illusion 2 album. Like it was, and Arnold Schwarzenegger's chasing him in the music video. I just know that.
And that was like a big deal. And like the hype for the movie was at an all-time high. Like you watch, I never had that powerhouse connection with Terminator 1, the original.
Yeah.
I liked it. But it was more like scary to me. Like when I was younger, it was like, and it was kind of cheesy. Like it was kind of dumb, but like also scary. And it was kind of boring too. And then like, you're like, all right, who's this a creep? You know, like he's trying to bone Linda Hamilton's character the entire
Michael
time.
Michael Biehn. Yeah.
Yeah. Michael Biehn's just trying to get it in the whole movie. And then, you know, he finally does. And then you're like, all right, what is this? And it's a good movie too, but it's not what
it's different.
It's completely different. Terminator 2 is the quintessential perfect action movie.
Yeah.
And all the hype and all the build and all built up to this release. And people forget, like, this is pre-internet.
Yeah.
There's no like going to Reddit to like get the right answer to like tell people what the right answer is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your smart take on the movie. Like you go to your job site and they're like, how was the movie? And you're like, it was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And then everyone goes, it was rated R and like people bringing mm-hmm. their kids and like people loved it.
Yeah.
The movie was a smash hit.
It was huge. It was huge. And it was because it sat on that foundation of the first Terminator. And it was what they did to change, subvert, expand. That's the art here in the idea of the sequel, which James Cameron has been weirdly one of the true pioneers of the great sequel. Not following Aliens, he goes into Terminator 2, and then even with Avatar, I think the second one works better because he's gotten all of the foundation, the mythology, mm-hmm. the expository things laid out. So he can now just venture the world and all of the detail that
Alien. And then he goes in the most famous pitch of all time, right? When he goes in and does the Aliens pitch.
I don't know it.
Oh, it's the best pitch ever. So he does Alien, the first one, right?
Well, Ridley Scott did that one.
Ridley Scott, right?
Yeah,
and then Ridley Scott. And so he goes in for, you know, to pitch Aliens too. And he writes out Aliens and then draws two lines through the S for like a dollar sign. You know, and I'm sure the executives did a big rail of coke and then fucking clapped him out of the room.
I mean, that sounds about right.
But, you know, all jokes aside, it was like, it sounds kind of dumb and cheesy, but like, it was like, he fucking knew what he was doing. And like, it was like right on the money. And he comes from that special effects background of, you know, like being able to like mold something and work it and like finding out how to like improve it, you know,
Yeah.
Like, and you see that when people that do special effects and props and like work with like intricate little things. Like you watch their skills grow over time. And so I think you see that too, like in his directing, like he gets better and better and better, whether it's True Lies or, you know, all these movies,
Titanic.
Yeah. I mean, massive love story, like, you know, turned it into a cool different take. And it was like one of the biggest movies of all time, yeah. You know, phenomenal director. But Terminator 2 for me, like it's the bee's knees, it's brass tacks. It's
I suppose then my follow-up question to that, to choose it, it's, you know, what was your foundation in your love of movies? What did it, and then how did that lead into experiences such as Terminator, like to find them, to love them? Was that part of the fabric of your love for movies, was discovering movies like Terminator 2? And how did it evolve after once you were exposed to it?
I think so. I mean, that's a good question. It wasn't like I come from like a big like movie background or, you know, like I was like in this movie world or, you know, I think it was literally, I played a lot of baseball growing up. And so we'd be traveling around playing baseball. And like when we weren't playing baseball on the weekends, I'd like, you know, sleep in and, you know, get up and like watch the movies on TNT and,
yeah,
you know, whatever. And like, yeah, and we'll just love it. And I think like that kind of enjoyment of like relaxing and taking it in gave me an appreciation for these specific type of genre movies that would be playing, yeah, over and over again. Yeah. But I think also too, it was back in like, you know, I was around for like the DVD craze and like, you know, like all these like, and like late VHS. And so like, we would just go to Blockbuster and just rent movies.
Yep.
And like, you just see like a cool poster and you'd be like, oh, that's what I'm going to get. And like, you know, sometimes you'd pick something like, you knew your mom or dad like wouldn't be stoked on, kind of try to trick them into it, you know, like slide it under there, like slide it under the Beauty and the Beast or whatever, you know?
I definitely did that myself. I not only worked at Blockbuster later in life in the tail end of their existence during college, but it was a regularity. There was a Blockbuster relatively close. I could walk to it. It was a bit of a walk, but I could, and I would be given a little bit of free rein if I went on my own. You know, my parents were a bit selective in what they allowed me to watch. But once I was using my own like allowance, or I was doing my own thing, they gave me some more leeway. They gave me some more forgiveness to what I wanted to experience. And so I started to discover movies like Terminator. You hear about Terminator, you know, sure, when I'm like, yeah, 13 and other kids are like watching rated R movies and I am not.
Yeah.
You hear about it. And so you want to be part of it. You want to be part of the conversation. You want to be part of the experience. These movies leave an imprint in that way, not only because of the imagery, the experience, the thrill, but that you just want to share it and remember it and be part of that collective memory. It's powerful stuff.
I mean, people forget or they don't know how powerful and how important movies were in people's lives. Now it's like, you know, something that's kind of like exist and like you partake in.
Well, it's called content now. It's not, yeah, it's not, yeah, it's not like an event. It's not something you share. It's just things out there.
There was no YouTube. There was no like iPhone, you know what I mean? Like people would watch, you know, the, like some movie and then like they would quote it for literally 2 years.
Like, yes.
You know, to the bane of their significant other hearing it over and over again.
I'm recalling the movie Diner. There's a character in Diner who's always quoting Sweet Smell of Success. And it's like this quirky dude. But I'm like, yeah, we do that. We did that with those movies. We did that with stand-up specials. Like, because you engaged with it so often, you could memorize it.
Or the Adam Sandler, like, comedy DVD that, yeah, was around that time period. Absolutely. The Jerky Boys or whatever. But I mean, it's the same kind of thing. Like it was that event, like your mom picks you up from school, you go to the movie store, you grab the microwave popcorn, you grab the movie, you each get one movie, you maybe get a game, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, if you've been good that week or whatever.
A game if you've been good. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so you go and then you like watch the movies and like, you know, sometimes you get the movie that like, it's just for me to like watch or whatever. And then like you get like the family movie, but it was like that shared kind of experience, you know?
Yeah.
Also too, like now everyone's on their fucking phones watching the movie and like half paying attention. And like movies are generally scripted for this short attention span audience that we have now. So we don't really get to like get into this traditional style of filmmaking type of stories. Yeah. But like when you can't pause the movie, or like, you know, maybe you get like one pause, like the entire movie. Yeah. Cause like you have, it's like an emergency and you have to go to the bathroom or something like happened.
Or more popcorn.
Yeah. Like, more popcorn, which is a legitimate emergency. More popcorn, bath, maybe a bathroom break, or, you know, some, like the house is on fire. That's like the three things that you can like pause the movie for. Cause then you make your family wait, and like people generally paid it more attention. They were better movie watchers. They're appreciative of the movies more back then. And I don't mean that to be insulting to the people listening.
No,
it's the fucking facts.
I think it's a general trend of our disinterest, disengagement because of phones, because of our rapid access, the immediacy of everything. I think when you grow up with, when you're trained in having like dial up internet and you have to like download something and it takes a day.
For a picture,
yeah. And we won't say what kinds, but
cool car. Yeah.
But you know, during that time, your patience is required to then engage in some entertainment, something that you value and that you keep, and so your appreciation is enhanced. I think now that something is so readily available, something that is so immediate, it does just naturally diminish in its appreciation, its quality because of that. And that's just facts. It's just how the world is evolving, and not in a good way. It's funny. We're going to be talking about a little bit about AI today because of the threat, but also maybe the evolving good that it can have.
Sure.
I talked earlier this week about Her and the complications, but that's a world painted in its isolation because of technology. And that is what's happening today. Technology is damaging our engagement. And it's not because technology is bad. The technology is not what it is. The tool is good. It's our ability to manipulate it for our own hollow means that is damaging.
Well, yeah, we fucked it up, right?
Yeah.
Like the robots are making the art and like we're doing the shitty jobs.
There you go.
Like, bad do we have to fuck up for that to happen? You know, like make the robots the like civilization slaves, and like we should be like eating grapes.
It should be
like,
inversed, isn't it?
We should be painting, eating grapes, like, you know, like as cartoon Romans
do the things.
Yes, yeah, they do the things for us.
But no, yeah, now they're the ones making art. They're the ones doing Picasso imitation.
What? Like they're getting all these fake views on YouTube, and it's nuts. Are we good diving into that? What do you want to do?
Well, no, I have my topics. Topics. All right, but,
sorry, I'm so excited.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's all exciting stuff. It's all good stuff. This movie prompts a lot of things for conversation. But to build to it, you became a producer. But you said that earlier on that you were doing baseball, that movies were kind of a casual thing, engagement. What shifted? What inspired you, or did you happen to fall into it? Was it something that developed over time?
Like me becoming a filmmaker type?
Filmmaker type, yeah.
I mean, I was kind of bouncing around colleges. I was playing football and baseball in college and bouncing around, and it was taking up a lot of my time. I was just kind of burnt out in sports. And then I got hurt, and then I was like, well, what do I do? And then you know, I was down in San Diego and I was going to school down there, and I was visiting friends up at Chapman University. And
Chapman has a great film school.
They do.
Yeah.
And you know, went up there, had a blast, got to know like a lot of their friends, and they were super cool guys. And long story short, just kind of ended up moving up there and then transferred to Cal State Fullerton. And was up there for the summer. And, you know, when they're doing, and it's very like Chapman's a very immersive film program, or at least it was, I'm sure it still is. And I think that's the proper way to go about it. It's, you know, filmmaking, you're always learning something every time you do it. So the best way to learn is by doing it over and over again. So like whether you're doing a sound class or a directing class or a writing class, they're always encouraging you to shoot a project. No matter how shitty it is, right?
Yeah.
You're going to make it with like three friends. Someone's doing sound, someone's shooting it, someone's acting in it, right?
Yeah.
And it's usually just like a, you know, some type of like basic prompt, like, all right, it's a chase scene, or, you know, and you film like a 1 minute chase scene of, or, you know, you're doing something with sound, you know, or whatever. Right. So like, you always need friends to kind of like help out, and it's already a small school.
Yeah.
So you run out of friends pretty quick to help you out after like the third or fourth or fifth or sixth or 18th movie.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. Or home movies, but like these little like projects that you're doing, these minute, 2 minute, 2-3 page kind of projects. Right. But I was like, oh, I'm down. This is like fresh to me, but it was kind of at like a good time because they were in their, you know, junior years, senior years, and they were doing the more advanced projects. So they're actually skilled and kind of, you know, working on, you know, relatively larger projects at the college level. So, you know, I was just down to help out and do whatever. And then, eventually, I was on a project, and then I think the producer got fired.
Interesting. That's pretty large.
Well, it wasn't like, you know, it's not like a studio gig, right? Where it's like, oh, you know, we're
But still, like, usually when even in the student realm, somebody who's been assigned the producer role is someone you suppose is in the trustworthy position.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And it was like he got fired. I don't know what, like, I think he like just like went home. He was like, fuck this, I'm out for the summer. Okay. It sucks
here. Well, there you go.
And so he just like bounced, and then or whatever happened, right? He got fired. And then the director was like, you do it. Like, you're already basically doing the job. Like, you just get the title now. Like, you just keep doing what you're doing. Like, don't worry about it. Just keep doing what you're doing. Like, I'll tell you what to do.
Okay.
I was like, okay. And then kept doing that. And it was awesome. Did it. And then someone's like, oh, like, can you help me on my thing? Like, you know, I was like, sure. And then like produce that job and produce the next job. And then, you know, for me, it was fun. Like, I wasn't really getting credit for it.
Yeah.
Like class credit or anything, but it was just a lot of fun. Like, I was having fun. It was super cool. It was interesting.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, like a lot of things I've never had to like think about, you know, or like, I was looking at things differently. It was kind of like, seeing color for the first time, in like a lot of ways,
or absolutely,
you know, like tasting, like it's like eating a first slice of pizza or something. Like, whoa. but it was like this, kind of, unleashing this, appreciation, I think, that I had for it. I think I've always been like a creative, type, you know, I've always loved problem solving and working outdoors. And so it's been a good mesh of like business and art and fun and seriousness and, you know, all these different kind of things. And I think ultimately like filmmaking is truly, encapsulates all of the arts and in all of the best pieces of the arts and presents them in one deliverable process, which I think is like a very beautiful thing, that like you can think of something and then create something that you can hold at the end of the day, like a DVD or, you know, and then and you know, you can have thousands and thousands of people have jobs and work on it, like combined effort to produce like one material good. It's a really cool thing. It's a cool idea that like you do that, you know?
Yeah. And to be part of it, you know, it's such a collaborative effort. Even though, you know, we associate people like producer or director, these like above the line fixtures, to be sort of in control. And certainly they are, they're managerial, they're directive, but you have to sort of know, you have to know the departments, you have to know who's best suited for the job at hand. And I know when it comes to producing and dealing with all of the people under the director, that you need to understand how the department is functioning, what they're doing, and then have that basic understanding. And I think that the immersive quality of like putting yourself through it, you learn it step by step, piece by piece, and you can see the whole, because it is kind of like a puzzle coming together, a very wonderful creative puzzle of different sorts of skills and expressions. It is a beautiful art form because of how many people are involved and how much goes into that final product that is just a, you know, that physical DVD, you know, it's a wonderful extension of it. It's really cool.
It's even like an art form on the business side as well. Yeah. You know, like you can't have the actors without the money, and you can't have the money without the actors. You got to somehow land them all at the same time. Just, you know, it's like the best of photography, the best of dance, theater, you know, lighting. I mean, it takes so many talented people to make a movie that it truly is a miracle that any of them get made.
Absolutely.
Especially now.
Yeah.
Even the bad ones.
Yeah. You know? Oh, no, like, absolutely.
Like, you're like, oh, this movie sucked. But like, hey, it saw its light of day. And I know your viewers probably know a lot about films, but I don't know if they realize how many films are quote unquote completed where they're in the can, right? Like, they've been shot, edited. They're even in the selling process, but they're never finished. They never reach distribution because of one of many thousands of things that could have happened. Maybe they didn't get all the releases. Maybe there was a dispute at a location, or maybe there was, they don't have enough money to process whatever the finishing costs, money for closed captioning, money for, you know, all the audio.
Oh my goodness. Audio stuff. Yeah.
So it's, you know, tens of thousands of dollars on the back end, which are just straight up hard costs. So like, it doesn't matter if your, you know, movie's millions of dollars or a $10,000 movie, you still have to pay these, it's not a proportional fee, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, how many of these films, they get to this point and they never see the light of day because they're just roadblocked from getting to the general public.
Yeah.
So it really is truly a miracle that anything
really is getting out there,
especially today, you know?
Yeah, it is, and we try and focus in on that because we have a lot of people who do work on films. We have people who are script supervisors or editors, people who are in the business in some form or another, you know, whether it's in the development, whether it's in producing, whether it is in post or production. Like, all of it signals that there's a lot of work. There's a lot of work that goes into every single film, and it's miraculous that it comes out because, you know, they worked within their limitations. Mm-hmm. They worked within the finite sense of a budget. They only had a certain number of people that they could have. And so when they get it out, we do try and highlight the fact that we need to appreciate. And that's why this whole show is not about like going onto a film and trying to just criticize exactly what's wrong with a movie, because I don't think that that's productive, because a product, something that has been made, has value to it based off of the things that go into it. And so that's what this whole show has been built upon, is looking at something in a context of history, time, budget, creation, everything that goes into it, and try and find a realm of appreciation.
I mean, I think it's good to disagree, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, in this day and age, it feels like everyone has to like get along and say the same thing and everything has to be perfect. And like, you know, kind of this walking on eggshells type culture that we've built ourselves on. But it's healthy. It's healthy to disagree. It's healthy to have different opinions.
Especially with art.
And not like it. And be like, I don't like that. And you're like, oh, I loved it. And you're like, whoa. Like, you know, like, what did you love about that?
Yeah.
And like, I want to learn, because you'll teach me. You'll teach me like, what did you, and you're like, oh, I might like how, you know, they presented this. And I'm like, oh, see, I didn't like that. And you're like, oh, interesting. Why didn't you like that? You know, and then I'll tell you. And then I'm not necessarily looking to change your opinion or mine, but it's like, it's a healthy conversation to have.
I don't think anyone entering those kinds of conversations should be aiming to change anyone's mind.
No.
It should be to learn what someone got out of an experience versus what you got out of it.
You also learn about yourself too, like
in
talking, because you're forced to kind of not necessarily defend, but kind of reflect on your own feelings and present that into sentences. Because you might feel a lot of ways about many different things, but you don't have to say them out loud, right?
No.
So when you're discussing something with somebody, you have to actually articulate that into words to communicate right back and forth. So, and it's hard to do. And so like, you'll be learning about yourself through this conversation a little bit. And I think that's like a really healthy process. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think I love 90s movies so much, is they were just unapologetically just whatever, right?
Like, certainly they were. Yeah.
This is the movie. Like, it's not like, I don't know. We saw something recently and it was like, we were in the theater and it was like, we were with the audience and like I couldn't even enjoy the movie because the audience was like bothering me so much. Like, it was like people who had seen it and like, they were like preemptively laughing at jokes like before they come out.
Yeah.
Like the cringiest type of like movie watching. Right.
Yeah.
And that like just simply did not exist. Like, I don't know how to like it was just love for the movies. And if you didn't like it, you wouldn't go, you know, like we have this like negative sense. Like, it's almost like, everyone knows how the sausage is made now. So it's like they have like too much knowledge and insight.
Too much information. But I don't know if it's the right information. I think it's this kind of superficial idea of what movie making is. It's like we see a lot about it. We talk a lot about it. Our whole pop culture ideas are informed about movies and engaging with it in some kind of superficial sense. But really, when it comes down to it, not everyone really knows what went into the process.
No, they think it's all sexy and like, you know, hey, that's Hollywood, baby. Like, that's the movie business. They don't realize that it's a lot of 4 a.m. calls to like the truck mechanic. Like, hey, we're having issues. Like, the lift gate won't go down. Or like, what do you mean the fucking, you know, you lost like some camera piece or like, what do you like, what do you mean it's not available? Or, you know, like someone just gets sick, like a really important person. Like, what do you do? Yeah. Like, these are normal people. And like, people just think that like, you know, like movies are invincible or that they're just, you know, and to give them credit, somehow movies are like movies are just almost, like the most like stubborn virus, like,
you know, because we keep wanting them.
See these projects and like everything will be going wrong and somehow they still complete get to the finish line. And I think it's more, you know, they're sure there's like the magic hand of the industry that kind of like moves everyone along, or like the movie gods or whatever you want to call it. But I think ultimately it's just kind of a testament to like the stubbornness and type of abuse that these like blue collared artists that make films are so fucking stubborn.
Yeah.
That they're going to just give you everything they have no matter what, because that's their like God given like plan to just make this fucking movie as good as possible. And that's who you have in the film industry. And these people are replaceable. It's the makeup artists that get 2 hours of sleep every night, you know, to put prosthetics on, the wardrobe ladies that, you know, have to take their clothes to the cleaners. And like, it's nuts. Like the mechanics that are working overnight to keep the trucks running, like all your Teamsters, like all their like really unappreciated, like unsexy type jobs.
Because there's this veil, this illusion of glamour to it, when really what you said, it is blue collar artistry.
Like when you watch the Academy Awards and you see like, oh, it's all the A-list like pretty people like in the front row, like where, like fuck that, like put the dude that runs the prop house in the front, you know, like that guy has been keeping the industry afloat for 80 years now, you
honestly know? Like, they should
stunt people get no love.
They like, should inverse if the Academy Awards were truly about celebrating,
that would be awesome.
Yeah, they should inverse, they
literally could, bring put the Teamsters in the front, bring all the prop house people, bring all the mechanics. Like, I mean, there's so many jobs. Like, there's so many jobs.
So many. Hundreds. Thousands. Like, it's insane, because my fiance Katie was, she has a friend's daughter who wants to go into maybe film. And so she was like, what jobs could I do? And Katie's like, so many things. And so she gave her a list. And it's like an insane amount of possibility.
Well, every job in Los Angeles is affected by the film industry.
Oh yeah.
For better or for worse. Like, you might think you're like, oh, but I'm a lawyer and I deal in like family law. You're like, okay, well, chances are that person like works at a, you know, a place that's affected by the film, and now they don't have money to do whatever. Like, you know, it's all just one kind of big pond that we're in here.
Absolutely.
Restaurants feel it.
Yeah.
Car dealerships feel it. You know, like craft stores feel like everyone feels it, you know, like.
And when people are sort of taking it for granted, taking the content, or they call it content, but taking their movies and television, everything for granted, and they're not really paying for it, and they're not really going out of their way to support it, it has a ripple effect.
No, that's a tough one, because it's kind of a double-edged sword, right?
Sure.
It's like everyone's kind of blaming each other, and everyone's a little bit right and everyone's a little bit wrong.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it started with like the stealing, right? The whole like the whole music thing, like with Napster and all that, like they could put an end to it and just paid Sean Parker millions of dollars and bought it out and figured out how to reverse engineer the bomb. Right.
Yeah.
And they chose not to, because they were going to be out of the industry. And, you know, like for whatever reason didn't happen, right? And then it moved on to movies and this, and like, you know, the internet just kind of evolved in general, but like they were never really ahead of that curve. And I think like it's this tough thing where, you know, you need like, I don't know, it's like
it's
like,
complicated.
Like, it's so complicated. We would spend 10 hours to barely scratch a surface, but the ultimate take is like these movies are super expensive. Like when you see like, oh, like that's a, you know, $20 million movie now, which is considered a pretty healthy budget for today's standards, was that would have been very low for like a 90s movie.
Absolutely. It would. Absolutely. It would.
So that, and you know, like, and relatively, like, I don't know if the internet's like, look it up right now, but it's like when you look at like with inflation, with that, that's a pretty small percentage.
No, it would be only a couple million dollars. Terminator 2 was the most expensive movie at its time. It was $100 million. With inflation, we're looking at almost $300 million.
Right. And then you also have to put in all the advertising, right? Which is, and the general rule of thumb, and it almost is to a T every time, is you take the budget of the movie and apply that to advertising.
Yeah.
So like
at least half
to the budget, right?
Yeah.
50 to 100%.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why movies that like feel like they're $20 million, like that's how you can like typically kind of like guess, because it just feels like it, like, oh, if you're seeing that billboard everywhere, like someone's watching it, or it's gonna be a huge flop,
you know. They're going all over there. One or the other for sure. Well, before we get into Terminator, I want to ask you, you know, for producing, you know, producer, you know, raises the money, gets all the people kind of together, departments and heads. And this is kind of paraphrasing. This is kind of simplistically saying what they do. But what inspires you for what projects you want to invest that kind of time to the creatives around you? You know, does it start with you, or does someone bring it to you? Where do you find the next thing that you work on?
That's tough. I think it's got to come from, it's usually someone you know, right? Again, kind of like, which then goes into the whole like nepotism kind of deal.
Well, I've never gotten a job in this industry without a friend involved. Sure. And so, yeah, I mean, it's nepotism per se, but it's network.
I think it's also, it's like you can trust, right? Like you can feel, you can feel like the passion, you can trust like what's there. There's just like a lot of pretenders and fakers in this industry too, which is also something that's like not talked about. Like just, you know, I like to call them time vampires, like people that just love to suck up your time and just waste like as much, like, I don't even know what they're doing, but it's like their job is just to go to like as many lunches as possible or something. They're just there going to lunches and sending out these emails.
Hollywood, like, lunch. Yeah, that's what it is.
They're sending out these emails and like going to these like weird pitch meetings. And I don't know, like maybe to them, that's like the validity of like, they're doing it, or like, you know, I don't know. It feels like a caricature of like a Hollywood producer. Oh,
100%.
Yeah. Like, you know, I don't know. Like the real people, like the people making all the moves and like writing, like they're not the flashy ones. It's like some dude in like a house in Tarzana just like, you know, cranks out the script in 4 days because it's something inspired her or him or, you know, whatever. And that's the story. And then they go and they call up their friend at Warner Brothers. They go in for the pitch meeting and they talk about it. And all right, like, we like it. Let's shoot it. You know, like it's not this whole like, oh, let's get the lunch, baby. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you
do? Yeah. Yeah. The schmoozers.
So I think, generally a project does have to kind of find you. It has to find you too, at kind of like the right time.
Yeah, sure.
And I think that's, for better or for worse, the most important part. It's not necessarily the project, but more about the timing of it, right?
Yeah.
The timing of the release, the timing, because you might have a good project, but it gets released at the wrong time, fail, right? You might have, you know, all the other elements, but it's not a good time. It's not a good time for like that director to shoot the movie, then the project fails, you know, or all these stars kind of have to align. And for me, I think it all comes down to timing more than anything.
For sure. Which is not something you can necessarily control.
No. And I think too, like, you know, it's like, you can have things like, you know, fast, good, or cheap or whatever.
Oh yeah.
Know?
And you can't have all three.
You can't, you can only choose two. Yeah. So, generally the trade-off is time for money, right? Yeah. So if you can chew things over a long period of time, you can stretch it out and do things for cheaper over a longer period of time. And that's like what people do to make low budget films. I think it's only getting harder and harder every year to kind of crack into that upper echelon of high-end filmmakers, especially the production types. I think it feels almost like they're coming from like venture capitalism.
Yeah.
Rather than actual filmmakers or people that know. Yeah. You know, you still have like the line producers and people that like run the crew and whatnot, who obviously know like what's going on. But it feels like as Hollywood becomes safer and safer with every film, and we export and cater to a more foreign market.
Yeah.
Namely China, the Chinese market.
I mean, when I went through UCLA Extension, they referred to it as, it was Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Yeah. I forget what they referred to it as.
Latin America always gets slept on. I feel like Latin America is such a underutilized market. Like, because they typically buy, you know? Like,
oh, yeah. Yeah. For
sure. They typically spend the money and they go and they have larger families and they bring the whole families to the movie and they get all the popcorn and they have a good time. But like, they actually buy the movies and like, they buy the music and like, and they're pretty like they're very like brand loyal. Like if they like a musician or they like a actor or they like a director, like they'll stick with them.
Yes, they will. They you will. Know? There is a sense of loyalty. Yeah. When you discover it. Well, and I guess maybe to shift it now to Terminator 2, you know, you're part of this industry, you know, the language of this industry. Was James Cameron, you know, the discovery of his work, being introduced to his work, did that become kind of a subconscious or backlog to like lean into and appreciate when you ended up getting into the industry? Because he is such a figure, not only for the technological advancement of the industry, but also just one of the grand prestige filmmakers, like somebody who comes from exploitation cinema and breaks into the prestige realm of the Academy. Like it's one of those great heroic creative tales that, again, he's got a bit of a hard edge, a bit of a fascistic take on set. It comes with some interesting stories, but people almost respect the man in that realm. Like, what is it about James Cameron that you respect and you come to with his an appreciation for his films?
It feels kind of like his journey is like kind of like the American dream in a way, you know, like he was just so talented. He forced himself in and kind of like made it, you know?
Yeah.
In reality, he's, you know, like low key, like a genius and also kind of like a dick. And I'm like, you know, like
I think most geniuses are dicks. Yeah.
It was like, he's like, you know, a little sprinkle of like bad guy in there, like some genius sprinkled in there, a little twist of like, you know, this, that, and whatever.
I think the crew made shirts for this production that I survived James Cameron or something like that.
Was that James Cameron or Michael Bay?
I think it was James Cameron.
Okay. Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know. Like it all depends. It's all like relative, I guess. Like,
oh, for sure.
It's tough. I mean, I don't support toxic filmmaking, obviously.
No.
Like, you know, you're on fucking set for 12 hours a day. Like, you know, tempers can flare and like, it's a long drawn out process. Like, I don't think anyone's lives need to be harder than they should be on set. That being said, I think, being a director, especially a high level director, in a position where there is a lot of pressure and you can't second guess yourself and you need to be decisive and make choices. I think, you know, like you're the captain of the ship, you're the general. There can be no mutinies on this journey. So, you know, and I think really if you ask anyone who's worked with any legendary high-end director, they're going to say they're all dicks. Mm-hmm. I hate to say it, you know?
Yeah.
I think like 90%, you're like, you know, sure, you get like one every once in a while, like, oh, he's the best, you know, and you're like, okay. But he also has like, what was their job? Like, I think for me too, the ultimate like barometer is like how Arnold talks about I look up to Arnold a lot. I think Arnold's like a great human being.
Yeah. Yeah. There's an interesting personality there he had like a persona that he was like leaning into, a public persona. I mean, that's how you're able to enter into politics and like and make that world happen. But as that persona has like evolved or extended and continued in his life and our exposure to it, there seems to be a kind of unvarnished earnestness and honesty to him. Like he's just going to call it out as he sees it. And there is something that you can appreciate about a person like that. Even if you don't agree with that person in their politics or in that vantage point, you can respect that he's telling you how it is to him.
Totally. Yeah. I think I have a lot of respect for Arnold. And I think like in a lot of ways I look up to Arnold and how he kind of accomplished so much, you know.
It's an incredible career.
But he has so much respect for Jimmy Cameron, as he likes to call him.
Jimmy Cameron.
So I think, you know, and on one hand, you're like, yeah, of course, fucking James Cameron's like very nice to Arnold, you know, and vice versa. But I think ultimately, too, like people like to gossip and talk shit. So,
well, and he even admitted it was a tough set. It was a tough set, but no one was ever, you know, begrudged by their experience or harmed by the experience. It's just a tough, and especially when you're operating at that level, with that budget, with that demand, you have to make sure things are going to go right and nobody's harmed, you know? And
I guess, I mean, that's just kind of how it is though. You know, like that's like, I don't care if you're playing professional baseball, it's going to be tough. Like you're going to go out there and like you get your ass kicked. Like, you know, you're a pitcher and you give up 8 runs. Like your career might just be over. Tough. Like that's how it works.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know.
It's a proving ground.
You're at the highest level of something. You're literally at the pinnacle. Right. So, you know, however you want to look at that, like there's pressure, whatever you want to call that. There's a very high level and, expectation to be successful, and you're at that level, they're not looking to make contacts, right? Everyone's there because they're the best of the best. They're there to, you know, make the best possible product.
Yeah.
And they're usually getting paid a lot of money to be there.
Yeah.
And so the expectations are very high.
Well, and I imagine that James Cameron also expects the best of himself. Like he, of course. Yeah. And so I have to say, you know, the thing that that James Cameron's films, you know, from Terminator to Abyss, Terminator 2, Titanic, Avatar, every so often there's one that I don't engage with in the same way that other people do. Avatar, the first Avatar being one of them. But then seeing something like the second Avatar and seeing how he doubles down on vision, how he doubles down on action, his conception of what cinema can do and what he can capture, what he can create. I don't think there's any better director in a sense of action and how he uses physical space and how he orients us in physical space. And I think that that's part of the equation as to what is the operatic largesse that he enhances with Terminator 2, is that his understanding of action and set piece and orienting you, the audience, with characters and your understanding of where they are versus where the people they are against are, that's what builds the tension, it builds the environment, and it all kind of, it's all like a tightly wound piece. And it's just so impressive. You know, what do you think about James Cameron's ability, you know, to put in the idea of the action set piece? Because obviously that's what really defines most of his work from even with Titanic.
I don't know. I don't even see a close second, you know, like I think he's so leaps and bounds ahead of everyone. It's just like Terminator 2, right? Like the boring part, right? Like where she's like, they like kind of like escape, like after they, after they go, I'm trying to think what happens actually in sequence. I think they blow up Dynacorp, right? Mm-hmm. And they escape, they like go to Mexico or like whatever that is.
Yeah. Yeah. After they escape the sanitarium where she's being held. Then they go to the boons, where she's got this militia that she's,
Well, so, don't they?
And then they go, and then she takes she the weapons. They get all weaponized. Yeah, they get all they get all their resources. Yeah.
So that's like the boring part of the movie, right?
Sure.
It's like there's like literally 10 minutes. It's like the boring part, and it's like the most like deep philosophical like lessons are being like presented.
Why
like,
do you cry?
Yeah. Why do you cry? Like no fate. Like dealing with these like really like you know, and it's like they're at the surface level. Like there's not driving them home, but it's like. Pretty like deep questions, you know, mm-hmm. like it's almost like a relief from the action. It feels almost like now, like nowadays, like how we like everything's a one hit wonder.
Sure. Right? Yeah.
It used to be like albums would come out. Yeah. Right. And so yeah. like the albums and just like where like that hit where the single would be placed on the album would kind of like dictate like the flow and the feel of the whole album. Like sometimes there'd be sketches and this and that, like, you know, there was like a theme or like a taste or a feeling for like the whole thing. And that's yeah. like, that's like what it feels like watching the movie. It's like riding a wave, you know, like he gives you just enough of a break to then like bring back the action again. And then you're excited. And then it's like
dips and peaks, dips and peaks. Yeah. And
it's not like, you know, just like you watch like Transformers or something. And it's like, I'm like, oh, I'm like 10 minutes in, just like with a headache and exhausted, like, get me out of here. I'm like, I'm pretty sure I've seen this. And I'm like, have I seen this before? Like, I know it's impossible because it just came out, but I feel like I've seen this before. I think just everything's like so fresh that he like, that he does, right? Yeah. Like a lot of times, like you'll see a movie and you'll be like, oh, that's the, you know, the Departed shot. That's the shot from this. That's a shot from whatever. Oh, they're shooting this now. Like, oh, I've never seen like, someone like morph through the metal bars before.
Yeah.
Like, I've never seen like that elevator shot where there's like the person's like running at the elevator. Like, you know, stuff like that where you're like, it's like literally iconic shot after iconic shot after iconic shot. And the setups are just fucking gold. Like
yeah.
the whole thing. Like, I mean, like even the location, like the location manager on that, like deserves
a huge pat in the back. Yeah. Like, yeah. To get the places that feel real, but also contained.
Yeah. The arcade, like a big shootout in a mall. And yeah. then they're driving the motorcycles and the truck through the, LA River, like aqueduct thing. Like,
and I think, and that's where it really is. It's like, and what's really substantial is that he was
like
able
like the motorcycle want, like, and that's not like that. Sure. It's a special effect, but it's like, beyond, you know, it's like,
he's going to
launch a motorcycle. It's kind of funny because you can kind of like see it. And like, that was like the quintessential shot on like every Circuit City TV.
Yeah. Right?
Like you go to Circuit City, you'd be like 8 years old. And on like 400 televisions, you see Arnold like launching off of that thing, like landing.
It's a great shot. It's none of it is haphazardly planned. All of it is meticulous. All of it is detail oriented. And it's the ability to articulate the action in a sense of blending the CGI. And what I like about him is that he has translated into the pure realm of CGI, but again, it's these elaborate blue screen sets for Avatar.
Sure.
It is all designed and oriented because he understands how it's all fixated, how the moving pieces, how the chess pieces move within a sense of action. I recall, you know, if you watch the DVD commentary, you know, when the T-1000's helicopter narrowly avoids certain doom, you know, going under
the... Dude, they were flying that for real.
He says, see this helicopter going under a freeway overpass?
That's real.
That's a helicopter going under a freeway overpass. Yeah, that's real. That's insane.
They would never do that now, obviously. But that's real.
It's real. And that's... I love that about it. It's the texture of
it. So fucking dangerous, organic, and out of control, but like so awesome.
But it is in control. I mean, I feel like they were willing to do it. The stunt people were willing to do it. He was willing to capture it. It might be a little bit of the insanity, like the maddening artist. But again, they controlled these environments.
But I guarantee you it wasn't like... oh, like we don't have the budget to bring the helicopter pilot on the tech scout, you know, like kind of bullshit that like pops up nowadays where it's like, yeah, they probably like talked about it for months, you know, and like looked
absolutely
at it.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure the helicopter pilot was pushing him more to do it, you know, like, I mean, that shit is just everything about that movie is awesome. And like everyone brings their A game And I don't know.
It blows your mind.
It gets me fired up even talking about it.
Right, well, now, let's do it. Let's get into it. Like, and I'll set up Terminator 2 for our topic today, and we'll get into all of the little subtopics underneath. But James Cameron, we're talking about today, and I mean, let's talk about someone who has launched himself into the stratosphere based off of really humble beginnings. And Bryson has said it's kind of like an American story because the Terminator was a surprise hit to a lot of people. It was a very low budget sci-fi slasher orientation. You know, it mixed sci-fi horror, brutal action, surprisingly bittersweet love story within it. But he was a graduate of the Roger Corman School of Hard Knocks, and he knew low budget fare. I mean, he worked on Battle Beyond the Stars, Piranha 2, The Spawning. Mm-hmm. And because of that background, and I think you see the best of both worlds in Terminator, you know that underneath the surface of those movies is somebody with ambition, somebody who wants to do more. And once he does Terminator, the floodgates open for possibility. He is invited then to do a sequel with Aliens. He then does The Abyss, which The Abyss was not necessarily a financial success, but it certainly was a push forward in the realm of technology that had everyone understanding Cameron in a different light. You know, we have to remember that the first Terminator was, with its cult sensation, was on a bed of exploitative cinema. It comes from this background of the filmmaker, you know, leaning into a sense of black humor, nonstop action, unrelenting suspense, bleak post-apocalyptic future, of an obsession about gadgetry within the film, but also because the filmmaker had an obsession about gadgetry. It was a creation of a futuristic time shift parable that ends up with it having an undertexture of mythology, history, and its own universe building that is pretty sensational. And that's why it built a foundation for an endlessly revisited time warped idea. And it sits on a foundation of smart, taut thriller, and it expands here. If there's only one film that you could claim to be the greatest action movie of all time, Terminator 2 sits in that consideration and almost does not, it cannot be dethroned. It cannot be necessarily removed. And it's because of what it did to build upon its origins and then mix the two worlds together. It's not as bleak as its original iteration, but it's because it focuses on the characters from a different vantage point, juxtaposes an idea of warmth and spectacle with them to bring us more into the stakes of what could happen with the apocalypse and how we can root for it to be stopped. It has remained the quintessential blockbuster masterpiece, and it's because of the cast, it's because of its clever plotting, the groundbreaking special effects, all of it. And, you know, it sits on, you know, some people have said it's like controversial or hypocritical that it sits at such a high budget coming from such humble origins. But honestly, that would be missing the point, because even, you know, it was posed to Roger Corman what he thought of the idea of expanding the idea of the B-movie into such largesse. And he even said, you can see it on the screen. It's over-the-top stunt set pieces, cars, motorcycles, trailer trucks, helicopters, Oscar-winning special effects. You see it all, and it's every step of the way and all of its choices. You know, the sequel to Terminator, a $6 million B-movie, almost couldn't have imagined it to be this scope, be this scale. But it used that foundation that it set up to expand in the world, expand the characters, and see them from a different vantage point, subvert your expectations. Sequels these days just do the same thing again and again and again, and it numbs us to that expectation. We need to look back upon the lessons that James Cameron has given us to essentially use it to make a grand gesture towards its differences, to subvert our expectations, change up the dynamics, and then within it embed us with a story of, you know, the idea of a replacement father, the warnings of AI, but also maybe the possibilities of the tools of technology enhancing with us. this movie has a lot embedded within its framework, not even just with the idea of spectacle and entertainment. There's a lot of engaging character piece. There's a lot of thought-provoking ideas, and it's all embedded seamlessly and effortlessly through the framework. So, Bryson, you've picked Terminator 2. What is it about it that makes it a favorite to you, and what has sustained an appreciation, or when you go back, where do you find more and more to respect and appreciate about Terminator 2 Judgment Day?
Man, I'm always so, I mean, everything about the movie is so good, right? And when you come into it, I think one of my favorite parts about Terminator 2 is that it almost feels like Terminator 1 was just an excuse for like the first 20 minutes of Terminator 2. You
know, sure. Yeah.
To make, you're not sure that Arnold's a good guy yet. You know, you don't know. And then, like you see that terror on Linda Hamilton's face when she's in the, you know, mental hospital trying to escape. And because the guy had literally spent 90 minutes in the previous movie trying to kill her.
Yeah.
Right. And they also reference it like, oh, the guy that's wanted from like the 1990 shootout at the, you know, whatever mall. I mean, that like to like utilize that in such a tasteful, creative, like fresh way, I don't think it's been done before or since.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm always really, really impressed by the sound design in that movie, whether it's like right off the bat, like those laser beams shooting, you know, where it's like in the future, or like the crushing of the skull.
The opening is one of the most sensational. Oh yeah. The music. Fridell's score is, cause he was invited back and they were very skeptical about, cause they wanted a little more, as they said, these kind of warmer textures, but he still was very avant-garde with mm-hmm. it. And I still think it works sensationally, you know, with the propulsive quality to it, the rhythmic quality to it. The opening is one of the greatest openings, I think, of all time. It's like this idea, because mm-hmm. they don't show you that because of money, of right. time, right. and of necessity in the original Terminator. But you know he comes from a future. It's like, what does that future hold? And now you get to see it in all of its incredibly bleak, but incredibly designed reality. It's really great.
But that's like a really tough decision to make as a filmmaker, yeah. right? Because you know you want to show that. So like that, because you keep alluding to it. So yeah. it's like, and it's easier to have like watched the movie and then like defend the idea because it worked. But like, you're like, oh, that is the right answer. But it you know, like I can just see that being such a hard decision to like, do we show this? Where in the movie do we show this? Like,
mm-hmm. yeah. And does it fulfill a promise that we have, because we all come to it with an imagination of totally. What it will be. And he needs to.
And you know, you got the note too, like, oh, this is going to be confusing the viewers. Like, do we show the, you know, mm-hmm. but it's done so perfectly because it shows what everyone's like, oh fuck, that is terrifying. Like, yeah. like a 10 foot tall skeleton, like iron, like a, you know, metal, like robot guy with like machine guns for arms, like coming to kill you. Like, okay, I get it now. That's
perpetual war. It's just a yeah. complete eradication and dystopian existence that, of course, once you show that, it's like, oh, we need to stop this from happening. We need to right. prevent this at almost at any cost. It almost puts you in a realm of forgetting the essence of humanity in your current state. I mean, that's what Sarah Connor's going through, is that she's so focused on the future that she cannot even comprehend the humanity of people around her, which is right. such a stunning, and it's because we know what she knows.
Yeah. She's like locked in, like she's somehow seen this too, you know, like yeah. It gives us that empathy for her. Right. And the frustration for her when they're kind of like, you know, gaslighting her, like, oh, sure, Sarah, the Terminator man came back through time. Oh, sure. And then later she's trying to trick the doctor. She's like, no, I know it was all a mistake, you know? And like, even that acting of like, she's acting like playing dumb kind of, but absolutely, not like in an overly obvious way. I mean, her acting in that movie was tremendous.
Dedicated performance.
I think there's a story too where I think there was like an argument broke out too because James Cameron wanted her to be nominated, I think, for Best Actress.
Oh, I mean,
And I think there's a story, I don't know if it's true or not, that he got into an argument and there was almost a fist fight with some of the guild members.
I have heard of rumors of fist fights and almost fist fights with James Cameron with a variety of topics. Sure. So it would not surprise me. It does show you that there's
performance was incredible.
It does show you that there's a genre bias in the Academy, especially because it still persists, although we see it break through every now and then with someone doing horror or some kind of sci-fi performance. But Linda Hamilton, just the physicality, the transformation, the work she puts into it. And again, this is a woman who is traumatized. And
she looks like it.
And she looks like
she
it.
She wears it. She looks like she's like malnourished via stress. You know,
yeah, that's a good way of putting it, because that's 100% what it is.
And you see her in like her daily routine is like flipping the bunk over and doing pull-ups because she's like, you know, so many more days till you know judgment day, and I gotta, you know, do anything I can, you know, like it's coming, I gotta get ready. Like,
yeah,
she's determined, and they just do such a good job of like setting it up. Very understandable. Like, okay, it's obviously understandable for the doctors, like why they don't believe, like she obviously does sound like a crazy person, but like we know it's true. Like we saw in the opening, we saw Arnold like teleport in this like weird orb thing, which by itself is like the coolest thing ever. You know, it's like orb just kind of appears and then like erases the fence.
Yeah. It just evaporates metal. It's like
fucking sick.
Yeah. The time travel device of it, which I like in this one, they don't even go the route of trying to explain it, because in the first one, I love it. They have a wonderful ability to just not address it, because Michael Biehn's character, Kyle Reese, is like, I don't know, I didn't fucking build the thing. Like, it's like, I like that because it's a B movie, we have to remember that it's built on B movie DNA.
Sure.
And you see it throughout. That opening is like if a Roger Corman...
But it's good though.
Because graduate had money, you know, that's what they would do.
But they also like, it's already happened. So like, there's like a less of a need to like explain it, you know,
yes,
like
for sure.
It's like normal somehow now because it's already been done. So like, they don't feel the need to be like, this is why they go into some stupid science explanation, like, which is a general problem that we have now with like today's movies.
Yes, we expect everything to be
to spoon feed the audience every fucking detail.
Yeah, spoon fed exposition leaves little to the imagination and actually disengages you from the process of trying to figure things out. Yeah, it feels
patronizing to an extent, which is like, I don't care, like, you know, like, I just move on.
Absolutely.
Also, too, like, people forget that, like, when there's a movie and like whatever, like the first 5 minutes, the audience, like, you know, they're going through their infantile stages of the film, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's no, like, you'll never be like, yeah, right, in the first 5 minutes. Like that's all setting and setup and whatever. Like, you're never going to go, that's not what he would do. Like, 'cause you don't know who that is. Like, you don't know what they would do or not do.
Yeah.
So like, you know, if you're a filmmaker out there and you're like, oh, like, should I take that chance? Yes. But do the crazy thing and put it within the first 5 to 10 minutes of the movie and you get away with it scot-free.
Yeah.
No questions asked.
Absolutely.
Later, when you've like set up the foundation work of like, you know, what's possible and what's not, then the audience has, you know, it's fair game for them to be like, oh, I don't think they would do that.
Yeah, there's now some rules being set. There's some things that we start to understand, and if they are out of the realm of what you think is possible with either the character and their decision making, or with whether the technology works in that way. Yeah, certainly. But I think this movie holds on to its world and sets it up right there in the beginning.
Somehow it feels believable that like naked Arnold like ports in like through this orb thing that kind of comes out of nowhere.
You know?
Like, you're like, okay. And then you believe it. And then, I also love too, the Terminator vision, you know, you get it at some points.
It like harkens back to Westworld, like Michael Crichton's Westworld, because that was like the first introduction of it. That was the first of like idea of a Terminator. But that was the first use of CGI as we know it, or the basis of CGI as we know it. And that vision, much more dated back then, you know, as compared to 1991. I mean, but I love that it has that kind of that sense that it is a gadget driven vision. I like it.
Have you seen like the videos of like when a Tesla is driving and like what like a Tesla sees?
Oh no, I have not seen this.
It's just like, it's like a road POV and it's just like little like shapes pop up or whatever. And it's very similar to like Terminator vision, but like way less impressive.
Okay. Yes.
So you're like, yeah. Oh dude.
It's
like,
definitely the Westworld version. Yeah,
it's a, like, you're like, okay. Like it feels like it's holding up a little bit. Like, you know, like Arnold's more advanced than like the Teslas on the road.
Well,
you know,
well, very, very much so. Yeah. I like that when he was like, can you see? He's like, I can see everything. And you get to see it a little bit.
Oh, at night, at nighttime?
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, it's like the road or whatever. I always loved the scene in the bar. Like, for me, it doesn't get better. Like, the music's good. Like, it's funny. And it just shows he's like, he's badass, right? Like,
that was an insistence upon Arnold to come back because it was a tough sell based on that he wasn't going to kill anybody in the movie. And he's like, well, that doesn't make sense. I'm the Terminator. And he goes, right. And so again, this goes to like the subversion, which I think is all part. It's not only a subversion of Arnold, it's a subversion of Linda Hamilton as you knew her. I think that that's the secret ingredient here as to why this sequel sets itself apart from other sequels, that why this one can enhance and be considered better than its foundation, because it builds upon it and does something different with it. And it goes into that scene. He requested, he goes, okay, I trust you, but just make me look cool. He just wanted to be cool. And right. That scene does it. It's like, yes, he does not kill a person in that scene, but he is, it sets up the idea where you remember this visage of the Terminator. It has to give us the promise of what he's capable of doing, but also in the same way that other villains have become sort of likable in a weird sense, such as Joker, such as Venom, they become anti-heroes because of their popularity. And right. I like that they leaned into that with this.
Well, yeah, I mean, it doesn't get better, right? He so effortlessly just like destroys everyone in that bar. And like, you know, it's for me, it's funny too, like when he like scans the dude and he gets like the perfect match and it's kind of like sizing him up or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he just kind of like, it's so robotic, right? He's like, I'm gonna need your boots, your bike, and I need your boots, your clothes, and your motorcycle. Your
motorcycle. Yeah.
And he's like, you forgot to say please. It's so good. And then he chucks the dude onto the grill in the back. And then like, you can see he's like, you know, he's scared. He's like, just take it. Like the badass biker dude's like begging him to take the bike.
Yeah.
And then the owner of the bar comes outside too with the shotgun, right? It's like how Arnold gets the gun. It's like the excuse.
The signature.
It's the excuse to give Arnold the gun, essentially. He's like, I can't let you take the man's
wheel, son.
And then he goes up, and that's how he gets not only the shotgun, but they do a good job of like when the bar owner's hands go up, like, don't hurt me. It like hides his sunglasses. So when he like looks like he's going to hurt him, he reaches out really quickly and then reveals the sunglasses that he puts on for like that signature, like badass like look.
Well, and again, I think I don't know what the trailers were like for this movie, but if you went into it saying Terminator 2, your expectation is that Arnold is going to be the villain. He's going to kill everybody. Yeah. That he is the unstoppable killing machine. We've seen this. You know, Terminator sets us up so wonderfully. If you have that information, he is like Michael Myers, but has the ability to like heal himself. He also is scarier than Michael Myers in a way, because Michael Myers is human at some point. Now they have this whole lore that he's some sort of druid inspired like entity. I don't go too deep into the Halloween lore, but here we have a killing machine that will not stop. Its mission is to kill this person, and it will not stop until it is done. And there's so much of that paranoia and that fear around that entity in the original Terminator, which I love. I love the original Terminator because of it. It's that idea of the never stopping force, and it can heal itself. Like there's that whole sequence where it is healing itself and understands its own mechanical apparatus. It's that blind march to death that it brings. And so that scene is crucial, because it's doing an interesting balancing act. It's not as serious as, say, him coming to, I think it's Griffith, is it Griffith Park? Kills Bill Paxton and all of them in the original Terminator.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and it, there's because he kills them, there's a more haunting element here. They're setting you up that something's a little bit different, something's a little bit off, but he is the visage and he still has the power and he still has the focus and he still has the drive as what you have set up before. And I think, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger gets a lot of shit for, you know, the simplicity of his action career, whether it's Running Man or Commando, Total Recall. Having been someone who has appreciated all of those in my foundation, but found an even deeper level of appreciation for some stuff like Total Recall and Terminator, right. I think his performance here, it's a self-aware, it's a knowledge of knowing his limitation, what he can bring, but it really does hone in to enhance the interesting subtleties about the differences between this Terminator versus the other Terminator. And that does take skill.
I mean, the whole thing's so well done, right? It's like that scene, right? It's such a, it's a delicate balance. Like it's funny. It's like, there is like some action element, but you're building that character that we're going to live with for the movie. Right. So like you said, he doesn't kill anybody, but he also like, you literally see him like suit up. It's like without doing like the cheesy montage, like the Batman style montage, you still get the same effect, even better. Right. Like when that George Thorogood song comes on, like bad to the bone, you know,
it's so 90s. It's
so perfect.
It's so 90s, but it works.
And then he peels out on the bike. Like you're like, oh, sick. Like you're all in. You love the Arnold character, right? You love the Terminator. And I hear what you're saying about like Arnold getting shit for like in Conan the Barbarian, like he struggled, like he wasn't good and whatever. Yeah. I think he really worked hard.
Absolutely. He did.
And I think in Terminator 2, it was like the perfect amount of like, I think he would have been able to like deliver a lot more, but I think the story was better with him saying less because everything he said had so much power, right? Like he would ask questions like, why do you cry? And, you know, like these kind of like deep things and like everything that he said was like a one line, it just hit so hard. And it went hand in hand with that larger in life type of character that he was, that impossible to, you know, just that huge feeling, that powerful machine, you know?
Yeah.
And then, but like all those people like that, you know, talk shit on Arnold. It's like, okay, like, have you seen True Lies? Like he's super charismatic and like,
he
talks the whole time and it's the same crew and that's a funny movie and he needs to be charming and deliver with comedic timing and he kills it. That's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah. He's got a diversity to him. Like again, we're not expecting the transformation of say Daniel Day-Lewis out of Arnold Schwarzenegger,
right?
But he has his skill and he has his abilities. And he leans into them. I love Total Recall because it is almost like a commentary about his own persona, about this expectation of like what his physical nature brings and what kind of world expects him to act in such a way on that idea of the fantasy of his visage and his physicality. I like the Terminator because there are shades and again they develop this, you know, James Cameron along with William Wisher, they had a challenge to expand upon the original Terminator and how there would be slight changes and evolutions. And there was a more explicit scene that was apparently Arnold's favorite about how that John Connor with his technical abilities would change the chip in order for him to feel emotions. They got rid of that because they were saying it was part of the AI process to begin with, that he is already kind of changing. And I think that if you pay really close attention to the performance, Arnold Schwarzenegger brings a really interesting shades of subtlety as he develops feelings, awareness, and ideas based off of his AI self-awareness, but also his connection that he's building with John.
Totally. And I think like at the end of the movie, right, when he's going down into like the molten lava pit
whatever,
at the molten lava factory, you know, he's getting lowered into one of the vats at the molten lava factory. You know, it's like it sounds cheesy, but like he's going down and he gives him a thumbs up, but like it with no context that sounds cheesy and lame, but like when you're watching it, like people are like crying. Like, I know.
It's a deeply emotional scene.
That's like a conversation I've had with like people. They're like, oh, like the Arnold thumb. They're like, yeah, like I cried when I was younger. You're like, it's okay, bro.
No,
like,
the thumbs up. The thumbs up out of context or when you're describing
it sounds stupid.
It sounds silly, but again,
it means a lot. Like we're gonna be okay. Like I'm gonna be okay. You're gonna be okay.
But
like,
it's the language that he's been learning from John the entire time. It's like he and John's been looking for a father, but the Terminator has now found some kind of relationship with a person that again was a mission but has developed into something different. And it's that expression again, it's a thumbs up. It might be the vernacular of the times. It might be very 90s, but it is how that child, how John Connor was engaged with him, hasta la vista baby, you know, all of those ideas come from John and learning from him. You know, AI as technology, it can build and learn.
Right.
It's and then it's about what are the good versus evil aspects of it, which I guess we can get back into the AI conversation here, because what's interesting about it is that even the movie tries to address this idea of weaponry, technology, is that there can be a good use for it or a bad use for it. You know, that we sit on this idea that the technology being developed by Joe Morton's character, and that it will bring upon the end. We're seeing shades of lessons about how technology is not just a definite bad. You get it in the scene when John's trying to learn about the function of the Terminator when the two guys come to try and help him. John starts to get a little cocky, as you know, a 13-year-old might do with he's power. 10.
He's 10.
Yeah, he's 10. Yeah, that's right. He's 10.
Everyone thinks he's 13. You'll assume he's 13 until you like look on your 50th viewing of the police like scanner thing.
He's 10 years old. Yeah. Well, there you go. Even but he's younger.
Not. That's the only mistake. Yeah, it's the only mistake in the entire movie. But yeah, I mean, for all intents and purposes, he's. He should be 13. He should be like, just make him 15.
Yeah, basically. But yeah, because 82 is when the events of Terminator happened. It's set in 95 is when Terminator 2. Is that?
I guess.
Yeah, I think that's how the math works out. But
he's like born a year later. I don't know. It says he's 10 on the thing.
Sure. But well, whatever. Anyway, he's a young kid. He's a young kid. He's, you know, he's a delinquent. He doesn't have good guidance. And once he sees that the Terminator can be used for his own purposes, he starts demanding him to like lift the guy. And then when
Piss
he pulls
off,
up,
dickwad,
dipshit, did you call moi dipshit? And then when he pulls out the gun, though, and John gets shocked and pushes the gun out of the way, it shows you that the technology can be ordered and insisted to do something that is bad, but it is the difference between what the choice and the demand. Right. Technology is there for our use. It can be used and engaged in, but it can be ordered to do negative things.
It is kind of an interesting juxtaposition because he is abusing the power.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Because those guys are there to like genuinely help him.
They are. I always get weirded out by that scene. But
hey, are you okay? Like they come over here.
Yeah.
And it is kind of weird. Like some buff biker dude and like some like young kid are like in a dark alleyway and he's yelling, help me in alleyway. And so the two meatheads run over, like, you know what I mean? Like good for them. And then like they end up getting shot for it. You know, you kind of feel bad for them a little bit.
Absolutely.
But it's like, you know, he is like abusing it because he's like messing with them like via Arnold. Right. And then but when he goes to shoot him, he stops him. So like he, you know, like you're saying, like he does like control the power and then he teaches Arnold like, no. And then like later when they're in, you know, the lab. Right. And all the cops show up. He's like, no, you promised. And then like Arnold like learned, right? And he's like, trust me. And he goes out there and doesn't kill any cops. He's
which, like, what precision? Man. What precision with a minigun that you must have in order to not the kill smoke grenades?
Yeah, and then smoke grenades are kind of like funny too, because he shoots him in the chest, so like, ooh, and they make like a funny noise and fall over, you know?
Yeah.
And they're like knocked out or whatever.
What a sensational sequence it is. And to then again, not only in the execution of the action, but again with the character, it's to show that it's like once told, the consideration has been processed and is in a constant state of recognition. Like it shows that AI while a tool and while it learns, it can learn really interesting habits. It can learn to learn jokes. Right. And so I like that James Cameron, who's been accused of, you know, enhancing all of the technology around film and that he's obsessed with these things, but also critical of technology, that he understands. He understands that they can be used as a benefit. In his world, technology enhances the quality and ability to tell artful stories, to tell stories. In the worlds that he criticizes, the technology has been abused and is using to create violence and inequity and injustice. And he's trying to kind of say that, you know, using the Terminator is kind of a launching point that the technology is not evil. It's how you use it.
I mean, the dangers that they warned us of, they're like, you know, he's like, no, like, why would they attack the Russians? They're our friends now. Because that was like a new thing way back then.
Very like, new.
Yeah, very new. And so.
Not our friends anymore. They're our friends
now. Why would we do that? They're our friends now. You know, now AI is like a threat. And like, now, yep, like Russia, yep, the war, you know, global scale nuclear war is possible with Russia. You know, I think there's like a lot of foresight in this movie for like just being like a fun action movie kind of deal. Like, again, I'm not trying to like build it up and make something it's not, but I do think that there was a lot of foresight and intelligent decisions and creative decisions that were made that a lot of people didn't think about, you know, like this isn't like a retro futurism, like bullshit ass movie. Like it's bringing up topics today that are more relevant than ever.
And bringing them up, I think, in a more complex notion than other films that have villainized or taken a villainous approach to AI, such as like The Matrix. The Matrix is very archetypal. It's very classic in its orientation of good versus evil. It just happens to land on that. The ambiguity comes later in the series in those conversations and complexities. Not that they handle it incredibly well, but that's besides the point. Here, even Terminator in the formula or the format, and again, it's building a formula. This is a formula that was not necessarily known as the Hollywood blockbuster, but it kind of solidifies it by engaging with these ideas and mixing them all. It mixes humor, it mixes action, it mixes these high concepts in order for them to be digestible, interesting, but also endure, because there's a little level of ambiguity and complexity to their consideration.
Yeah, it's I don't know, it's the whole package for me.
Yeah,
I think I mean, it does ask a lot of questions, because it shows that the maker is kind of the decision maker ultimately, like to guide the machine, right? So it's like, you know, they're using Arnold for good. Mm-hmm. Right, the T-1000's out to go kill them the whole time.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, what do you do? Like, you know.
Well, and then it also evolves that relationship. Like, what is John looking out for? What is he looking for in the realm of the Terminator? It's and a lot of people have talked about, you know, even James Cameron, when he talks about the movie, is that it's about like the Tin Man and finding his heart. And in order for it to be like that, in order to have that kind of Wizard of Oz archetypal foundation and influence, you have to have something pretty meaningful within it. And what does the role of the Terminator take on is this kind of surrogate father. And while it's not like as enhanced, because he's almost childlike, he's learning from John. Sure. At the same time. And so you could say that it's this relationship that they feed into each other, because they can lean and depend and trust and build, you know, a better understanding of each other through each other. And I like that aspect of it.
It almost feels too like Arnold wins, because like the things he learned from the humans, like the love that he's taught and like the resilience and whatever. Right. And they do it in like a very subtle way. Like throughout the entire movie, like they'll straight up just admit, they're like, he's a more advanced killing machine, you know, like, mm-hmm. Like he can take on complex like positions and whatever. And so like they acknowledge the entire movie that Arnold's outgunned. Like they're always barely escaping. Like somehow mm-hmm. they're barely getting by. And it's always like a very tastefully done to me that like they can they're just like surviving essentially. And then at the very end, they kind of pull one over and they get like lucky, but it's like, you know, like Arnold's like dead and he kind of comes back to life and, you know, Linda Hamilton shooting him with the shotgun and runs out of the ammo. And then Arnold kind of comes over the top with a grenade launcher, you know,
it's great.
And blasts him in there. And then like, basically like just like dies, you know, or he's like, you know, then he's got to get lowered down into like the molten lava vat.
I like the element you brought up about how the struggle, it's like Arnold Schwarzenegger in our idea of it is invincible. Then the Terminator, the T-800 is an invincible machine.
Right.
It won't stop. The T-1000 is such a great addition to the movie. And we have to thank great Robert Patrick for bringing it to life. That chilly. Yeah, he was living in his car like while he auditioned for this, which is insane to think about. And the fact that he was able, it's everything that goes into this performance, I think, obviously, I think is greatly appreciated from many people. I don't know if you hear a lot of criticism from it, but it's so it seems so effortless, and yet for him to run without a sense that he is, I feel like any he sort of that. Tired. Yeah.
Like he learned to walk so Tom Cruise could run. You know, like
Tom Cruise has a similar run. Absolutely.
He did the run first. Like that was the guy.
And it's the combination. It's again, his physical presence that he brings to the role. It's his chilly, calculated, disengaged demeanor. It's funny that they talk about that they put him in a cop uniform to avoid suspicion. And I feel like in our world today, it has enhanced suspicion in some ways. But again, it is a figure of authority. And so it plays into the idea that this guy is perhaps the one who's here to protect John. And I and it's because they're again, it's the performances are contrasting and juxtaposing with each other that they are equally as detached as the other person. So you cannot necessarily know who's behind it. But Robert Patrick is sensational in this movie. There's a reason why it's one of the greatest villains of all time.
He just has like a there's just like a level of acting there that like you like a level of intensity that comes through the eyes.
Oh yeah.
And just kind of like that, his facial structure and like that coldness that says so much, like when he's just kind of like looking around and just kind of like, you know, scanning or whatever, it just feels so cold. And like there's so much intensity in each of those things. It's my favorite role that he's ever been. Like you watch him in things after and you're almost like disappointed, you know? But he's incredible in that. And I mean, there was probably a ton of people that like that was like peak for them. You know, there's a lot of peaks like in that movie. But that character in general, too, was just awesome. Like, I also love that it's like T-800 and T-1000. Like, sure, it's got the mold. It's like 200 better. Like, it's like a little bit better. It's like enough so you know, but like not like it's not like the T-1600 is not twice as better. It's like just 200 more better.
And just enhanced through the CGI, which I think we could talk about as well. It's like that combo effect. It's like the best movies to utilize CGI have a foot in both camps, right? It's like Jurassic Park. It's like we're here in a physical reality. We have puppets, we have animatronics, but we also have CGI. It's that blend of the two that makes those otherworldly possibilities with CGI incredibly organic within the tapestry of the world and the experience. And it's the fact that he dedicates himself and the combo behind it with, you know, and the Industrial Light and Magic and the advent here of like CGI, like the precursors of perfecting it, the T-1000, I mean the CGI costs thousands of dollars alone, but it's really in its execution, the combo effect, you know, the liquid metal Terminator that apparently James Cameron wanted in the first movie, but they didn't have the technology, they didn't have the capabilities, they didn't have the money. But this creation is brought to life, and it's through the experimentation, the generated imagery that he did on the Abyss, and now you're seeing it with the combo of a physical person and the digital creation of him too. it's such a wonderful element. And again, it's like how his arms form, but then like Robert Patrick or the stuntman clearly has like a physical like extension
right.
to combine the effect. It that's what really sells it.
Yeah, and it holds up, and it's like it's awesome. I think too, like some of the shit in that movie was just fucking so good. And like I'm watching this now with like everything I know, and like still like it's a lot of it's very impressive.
You know? Oh yeah.
Like the Linda, so like when that scene when they're doing the they're going into Arnold's head, right? And they like literally like wrap around him, and so you see Linda Hamilton, and then they go around Arnold, right? So that whole thing, it's like they were only able to do that because Linda Hamilton has a twin.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's a flat. There's no real window, right? It's like a fake Arnold and a real Arnold. So when you come around, you see Linda and Arnold, and like it's supposed to feel like the reflection, but it's not.
Yeah.
So like the fake Arnold and Linda's twins on camera side, right?
Yeah.
And that's who's like operating, and they're like kind of like mirroring each other, and like that's how they're able to like go.
That's an insane coordination. Yeah, absolutely.
Totally. But that's like what sells like the realism of the movie. They're like pulling like a core out of his head, like, you know, or like when they go into the dude's house, and like I always love that scene too, where it's like everyone's kind of on the same page, like Sarah Connor's trying to kill the guy, and like they go and they stop him, you know, and they're like trying to explain everything, and then he looks up to Arnold and goes, "Show him." And Arnold's just like on the same page, and like pulls up his hand and like literally cuts his human skin off and like pulls it up and like sees the arm, you know?
Yeah.
But it's like the guy knows right away because like he has that.
Yeah. He sees exactly.
And
gives him the image.
Like there's so much that's like told story wise in that like 10 seconds, you know, like show him like, and he cuts his arm off. So like him and the kid have like this kind of semblance, like they're on the same page. Right. And then like now Sarah's taking orders from John. Right. Like she's like looking into him more as like a leader type,
which is interesting because she has fashioned him to be that, but she's still reluctant to give it to him because like to make his own decisions.
I think he earns it there.
Because
he tells her to stop killing the guy. And then she listens to him.
Yeah.
And I think that's like the big turning point. Cause then he shows him the hand and then he realizes, oh shit, like I'm making this stuff. And so when she tells him like what's going to happen in the future, he's like, oh man, like, you know, like, oh, he took it. They skip over like all the boring parts of like retelling all the things we know.
Yes. Yeah.
So they just like sum it up quickly with like, he took it pretty well for a guy that
Killed 3 billion people. Yeah.
Billion people.
Or yeah. It's almost like a parallel to like how Oppenheimer feels at the end of the movie. Right, you know, yeah. It's very much that kind of residual effect, that moral effect. What's interesting about this, and especially with John earning his stripes here, and, you know, because he's lacked guidance, he's lacked, you know, a father figure, but his mother has also trained him for a very particular idea of the future. And it's because she's so fixated on what she knows that the future will happen. It's apocalyptic. It will end. And many, many people will die. I feel like we can do a compare contrast with the psychology that people have with like sort of environmental collapse, which I think is very much a credible fear to have. But what ends up happening is that through a lens of fear in this way, you see what happens to Sarah Connor is that she starts to diminish the value of human life, where she's becoming more machine than the Terminator itself.
Right.
And I think that's an interesting lesson and realization she has to come to, is that when she is confronted with just senseless murder and slaughter of not only Joe Morton, but also the family, something clicks. John comes, but she has also sort of collapsed in on herself right at the same time. There's a snap realization that her humanity is trying to kind of reach through. And I think that to be conscious of the future and what needs to change is very much viable and very much needed. But you also can't forget the present. She's too wrapped up in the future to consider. You see that when she like when she checks John for wounds, you know, it's like she's not really concerned about John, his well-being, mental well-being, and the state of being in the present. It's more about, are you okay so that you can be in the future?
Yeah, future. Yeah. She's worried about future John, not like current John, and like how he might be emotionally damaged or like, you know, like what she's doing. No, and I think it's a good point. And I think that's like, you know, part of what I was talking about with like some of the things that were, whether they were done on purpose or not, like the foresight and intelligence of like these little nuanced things like,
yeah,
like that. Right. I think it's a good point. She does become like at some point the problem, like she's just killing humans recklessly.
Yes. Because, yeah.
And, you know, to a certain extent, you kind of understand it and it's justifiable, but you're like, you didn't try like explaining it, I guess. But I guess like, you know, you kind of like feel her a little bit, but like that's that, like that kind of like, you know, very carefully crafted storytelling, like gives John the power to become this great leader, essentially, right? Yeah. Even though he's kind of this like annoying little kid with a squeaky voice.
I was going to ask you how you feel about Edward Furlong in this movie. I feel like we've all accepted him as part of the tapestry of it, like the because that's just what it is. His performance is what it is. I know that they had some issues with audio, you know, audio and audio, overlaying his ADR. I
mean, the movie's so good that you like move past that, you know. And it's funny, that was one of the first things I said. I'm always impressed with the audio. But yeah, I guess they had to redub the entire movie because his voice kept squeaking and changing. And so at certain points, it's very noticeable.
Especially in the beginning. The beginning is pretty grating.
Right.
I'm going to go on record and say I'm not a big Edward Furlong fan. And I think this extends beyond Terminator 2. It goes to like Pecker. It's what else is he in off the top of my head? American History X. I'm just not a big fan of Edward Furlong.
No.
And it tells you that the power of the film and its themes and its set pieces and the other characters and everything involved is so good that you just kind of accept him as part of the rhythm.
He is good for being that kind of shithead kid, though.
Oh, absolutely.
So yeah, like for like very believable that he's like the foster kid that's like causing all the problems, and he's like a shithead kid who's like stealing and like doing all these kind of bad things.
Oh, I think it's quite believable. Yeah. I'm it's not even in how the character's written and done. It's just in the little textures here and
there. Yeah. At certain times he is kind of annoying. But I think that's kind of like, in a way, I think it kind of feeds into the charm, whether by accident or design, is that like it doesn't matter that he's annoying. Like the Terminator is there to protect him no matter what. And I think like Sarah says at some point in the story, like all the men who have come and gone, and
yes, that's
like, he'll
right,
never be like you know, like the machine, like it'll always be by his side no matter what. And you know,
it is interesting how quickly she comes to accept I suppose the evidence is in the saving. Like once she has been, her fear comes out in seeing the Terminator, but once he has saved them, it seems like the evidence is there, and she's very quick to be like, no, you should be with the Terminator. You should just be with this guy.
She has kind of that weird like moment where she's like in the desert, you know, and she's mm-hmm. kind of carving. So that's probably like her like thought process, or I don't know, whatever. I still think that turning point, it's very subtle, like when they're at the house, you know.
Yeah.
And John's like, show him, and then like, and like that's a great special effect moment too.
Oh, it is incredible.
Because he pulls his hand off, and you can see he kind of like Arnold's hands kind of like tied under his shirt just a little bit,
just a little bit.
If you're looking for it, right? But it's like a great special effect moment where it's like, you know, you see this like very impressive robot hand and it's like moving, you know, like they're clearly like operating it from like the elbow
off of the
screen, but it's like framed up so perfectly so like you barely don't see it, you know, like, and it's like moving, and it's just, it's so believable and looks so good. And then I think even like the wardrobe, so like she's wearing like all black and like that hat, and it looks very like aggressive and cool, and like, you know, she has, you know, the big long silencer and like the red dot scope, like, which cracks me up because she's like taking a shot at him and he's like 25 feet away. Like she doesn't really need it, but
you know, I described her as a machine, and I don't put the blame on her because I think you were right. We do understand her. We understand that she has been traumatized by a 90-minute movie, you know, like that experience would change you. We see her also under surveillance and also under judgment, constantly being, you know, having, you know, being a woman who is not believed in this world and has to operate and like depend on herself. I like that she is, and Linda Hamilton is one of those characters. You can put her along with Sigourney Weaver for establishing these amazing autonomous anti-feminine displays of womanhood, badass women, and they take and honestly, we can say that maybe the Terminator ultimately gets the final shot there, but it's because of her dedication. They're almost acting like equals and partners in the action.
Without Sarah Connor, the Terminator loses like several times.
Very much, yeah.
I think the only time he would win was the time when he was at the mall by himself and he just kind of like won by running away barely.
Yeah. They just were able to get away.
They just keep escaping.
Able to get away. But yeah, you sitting in Sarah Connor's like psychology, you would understand why you would lose sight of the present of humanity and the value of humanity because as it exists in the way it's because of how she's treated, what she's gone through. And then you get that haunting nightmare sequence, and you get the idea that maybe she sees that every night.
The A-bomb,
A-bomb night.
There's some other thing too where it's like they were scientists, like look at that as like the most realistic like representation of like what would happen.
It's horrifying. Yeah. And how they generate that the believability of it, the physicality of it, just everyone turning to melting in fire and turning to ash, and then her skeleton. Just
holding on the fence
and the skin being blown away and melted off. It's so horrifying, so well done. It shows you that James Cameron never left behind his B-movie exploitation years. Like, he just has enhanced it. He's taken it to a new level. And it's so, I mean, situated in that psychology, you do not blame Sarah Connor. That's why she never enters a sense of, like, condemnation or the audience seeking judgment on her.
Right.
No, we understand, and it takes a lot to remove yourself from that trauma and that turmoil.
Well, I think that's why it's a good scene too, especially for John Connor, because like the audience gets a little slap on the wrist too, because you're like, yeah, kill that guy, like save the world, and you're like, oh, like, you know, you find yourself kind of like rooting for him, but like. That guy didn't do anything. He just works at like a lab where they serve
he's just studying.
They serve a lot of Pepsi for some reason. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of Pepsi product placement in his laboratory. There's like some dudes walking with a Pepsi on a tray.
It did not convince me. I do not like Pepsi.
They walk by. Yeah, I don't like Pepsi either. They walk by like a vending machine, and there's like another Pepsi in the background. There's a lot of Pepsi in that laboratory. But no, I think it is good. It is a commentary of like how we get caught up, right? Like. It's the same thing with like this big environmental push. Like, I don't dive into the politics at all. But it's like everyone's like, "Yeah, green, like let's do it." And you're like, "Okay, like, can we talk about it? Like,
what are the implications? What cost, right? Yeah, what are the implications, and what happens when you put something into effect?
We're not using green energy to extract these metals, and then like who's extracting them? Like, you know, like child labor, unethical labor, like." You know, that the diamond industry was criticized for years over, and now it's being used to extract precious metals from the earth. So you can feel good about not going to the gas station.
Sure.
You know, it's a give take, and it's all about perspective. And I think ultimately too, like this movie, it's a good reminder. And I think ultimately too, it's what truly makes it great is that, even though you'll sit in a room with someone, you'll take away kind of a different experience, right?
Yeah.
You might be like, oh, I'm emotionally touched with, you know, John Connor and the T-800's relationship. Oh, wow, I'm moved by, you know, that commentary on society. Or, wow, that was a badass movie with just a lot of cool explosions and, you know, guns and stuff.
It has all those layers.
So, and it does it with all the cheap gimmicks, you know, like mm-hmm. they're, you know, like without the flamethrowers and the strip club scenes and all the kind of shit that like typically you have to throw in there to spice up a movie, like, which, you know, there's nothing wrong with that kind of stuff.
No.
That's very much of the genre and the age.
Yeah.
It just did it, and it did it clean. And it for me, that's why it rocks. It's just, it's the shit.
No, it captures such an idea of science fiction as it's coming into its own and into its ideas in the realm of cinema. Like it's kind of taking its foundations from the past and building upon them, enhancing them, taking them to their ultimate kind of cinematic conclusions, which ultimately comes to an idea of confrontation with it. Well, I think the action is the confrontation.
I think if you ask a lot of people too, you're like, yo, are you into sci-fi? They'd be like, you know, especially that time, like, hell no, nerd, you know, like that's like outer space and robot, you know, whatever. But like, you're like, oh, what about like Terminator 2? And like, oh, I love that movie. You're like, okay, that's sci-fi. Like, mm-hmm. So you love sci-fi.
It's because of the organic gadgetry of it. Yeah.
It was like a gateway to like, and there, you know, then that's the thing with sci-fi. It's always kind of like comedians, right? They're always kind of like questioning like ethical behaviors and taking different stances and kind of like reversing roles and looking at things from a different perspective and kind of questioning it, that I think is important. And, you know, in today's society, lacking. For some reason, you can't question authority anymore. Mm-hmm. You can't question the government or your parents, your employers, or, you know, what's going on. Like, that's kind of like what
it's all about, the fabric of this. Our
freedom, you know, like,
yeah, is about that's questioning. What makes
it beautiful. It's like figuring it out and thinking and whatever. So it feels very, it's interesting rewatching a movie from so long ago that's so relevant. It's almost kind of chilling and telling to the complexities of today's society. And what a great job they did as filmmakers and storytellers.
Absolutely. And it goes down to how James Cameron comes up with this conceptually and then meticulously organizes it for its execution. And we can talk, I mean, we've talked about all of its functions and all of its, all of the skill that goes into all of the pieces, all of the individual pieces that make this an incredible movie. And we could talk about them for hours upon hours in each of its segments. Like I feel like a 2-hour conversation, which we're coming to, and we'll lean into a conclusion soon, is it almost doesn't do it the full service that we could, because we could talk about the special effects and what makes it revolutionary of its time, like in all of its detail. We could talk about the action set pieces and how they were. That it's all in a space of a physical space, and that enhances its piece by piece qualities. But honestly, you can't talk about it without talking about the characters and what they represent. You know, from the differences of the AI, the weapons at their clashing representation from the T-1000 to the T-800, and what they mean to Sarah Connor and John Connor as they are confronted with senses of their own ideas of identity, and then the challenges of what they expect in that world as it comes to its reality. Terminator 2 Judgment Day really is a sensational example of how you take on a continuation of a story and of characters and deepen them, change them, see them from a different avenue, subvert the expectations of audience. This is why it is considered one of the greatest sequels of all time. You know, most of the time people say the sequel is not better than the original, and it's usually a defined rule. But honestly, this movie puts into question that whole apparatus, and it's because of how they took it on at face value. They wanted to do something different, creatively different, philosophically different, and everyone came on board to make that possible, from Arnold Schwarzenegger to Linda Hamilton to James Cameron. All of them wanted to seek out a different creative vantage point, and that's what makes it Excuse me. That's what makes it pretty substantial. I think we should go to conclusion, but I want to give you, Bryson, the final words. You know, how would you like to summarize our talk here on Terminator 2? And if there was anything we didn't necessarily say or anything that you'd like to talk about, now would be the time.
No, I think you nailed it. I think they took a huge risk.
Absolutely.
And they changed it up. And, you know, all across the board, they took a risk from the storytelling to, you know, who played the villain, right? Mm-hmm. A relatively unknown Robert Patrick.
Yeah. Apparently it was Billy Idol was going to play I see that look on your face. Apparently was cast and got injured while shooting something, and so they needed to find someone else.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah. Right. Would have been totally different.
Different movie, yeah. I don't think we'd be here somehow. I don't want to build it up too, because everyone has their kind of like own opinions, and I don't want to play this as, you know, this, like, this is not like the Bible, or like, you know, if for some reason you haven't seen it, I wouldn't expect it to change your life, or, you know, I just think it's such an important piece of cinema history for what it unlocks and what it was able to do and accomplish, and how much joy I think it brought people over the years. And just, I think it's just like a quality commentary of the times, and especially relevant now.
Absolutely. And it captures such a unique, like, vision of LA. You know, we live in LA, and I definitely remember those times. I mean, how the 90s felt. It's kind of a snapshot, but it also is incredibly weirdly familiar. Like it has not changed too much.
Even like the opening, like they just made it look like hot and smoggy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like kind of like insufferable, like eeny, like, you know, and kind of like all those, like the heat waves going through, like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And then contrasted with that cool, like, and then like the machines in the future, like just the color temperature swap, like
it's the color temperature,
hot, the feeling warm, hot to uncomfortable cold, yeah. To just like it just it, like it feels cold, like you feel cold watching that scene, and it's like, you know, in this like bone chilling kind of way, like watching a human skull just get crushed by like a monster machine.
Yeah, it's an incredible visage, incredible iconic use of the T-800 and its ideas.
It's fucking, the effects are better than most movies now.
Oh, it's absolutely. You can thank the Stan Winston, their original creation.
Sure, some of the VFX like aren't like, you know, they're not like modern, right? Like, and you see it when the sheriff's like getting the coffee.
Yeah.
Right. And he like, his twin like morphs off of the floor. And like, you're like, all right, it's like a little, still doesn't look bad. Like it doesn't like,
Yeah. It's not what CGI can do today, but it doesn't look bad. It works. It's
decent.
Yeah, yeah. It works in its way. And also the fact that they then blend it with the prosthetics, where the blade, you know, the icicle, the metal liquid icicle goes through his eye, John's foster dad.
That's another twin.
Yeah.
That's another twin situation with the two cops.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just smart, right? Like, I don't know.
Smart, like smart organization.
Yeah, it's just thinking ahead, and it's like, oh, you have a twin. Like, how do we utilize that?
Those guys are in Gremlins 2, New Batch. They are the scientists. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, that's right. I connected the two together. Joe Dante, who also worked under the Roger Corman School of
there it is.
Yeah.
With the step parents, right? Like, how's Wolfie? Wolfie's fine, honey. Your step parents are dead.
It's great. It's a great scene.
But then it's like a cut back reveal, and like it cuts back, and she's like, she just looks evil.
Yeah.
And like reveal this like icicle finger like coming out through the milk carton. Like, it's so good.
Yeah, that's Jeanette Goldstein, who I always love. She's in
But even Aliens. That prosthetic is fucking awesome.
Oh, too. Yeah, that prosthetic's good. The visualization of it. That's one of those scenes that I always think about when you say Terminator 2. I think of the sword, the blade through the milk in his mouth. It's pretty incredible visualization and an impactful use of violence. I mean, and that's the first introduction that the T-1000 can imitate people. And what a haunting implication that is for the rest of the
film. Isn't it with a cop?
No, because he has the, no, he is like Robert Patrick when he first approaches him. Yeah.
Oh,
the cop is not Robert Patrick. Yeah. I thought that was going to be the introduction, but
right.
No.
That's right.
He
just takes on his uniform.
He just takes his uniform. That's it. Yeah. Well, Bryson, I thought this was a great conversation. I want to thank you so much. Yeah, thanks so much for coming in. It's always great catching up with you, talking about industry, but also talking about one of your favorites. You know, I remember we had like a 3-hour conversation about Heat. So it's
I mean, you know, I'm a fan of talking about the movies longer than the movies actually are. You know?
Well, and this one we're a little lower, less because it's a 2.5-hour movie. But
snuck in under.
But I know you produced a movie. Was it last year? Did it come out?
So we were the first film to get SAG approval to go ahead.
Oh, that's amazing! Yeah, I remember that.
During the pandemic, we went out and we shot. It came out last year, and it's out doing its thing. It's just kind of on.
Can they find it?
Somewhere? Yeah, Manifest West. Go check it out. Small indie drama film.
Go support indies. That's the indies. a big thing. I'm a big advocate of indies. So yeah,
it's a cool story. It touches on mental health. It's told from the perspective of an 8-year-old girl, and so it's definitely unique. And I think it asks some important questions that I think we need to kind of reflect on. That I think are, you know, becoming more and more relevant. Kind of like, what is mental health? How we, you know, associate the human family unit. It was a great little project that Joe Deitch, Louis Gibson, and myself and a handful of others went out and shot this during the pandemic. And we were kind of like the test guinea pigs to see if filmmaking could be done, you know, out there in the mist. And we survived and no one got it. Yeah. Well, so go check it out. It is on like some streaming platforms. I don't know what it's on now. I think it's on, I think it's just on VOD. You can find it and you can rent it from anywhere.
Okay. Well, there you go. Well, Manifest West, go check it out. Are you gearing up for something else?
Not right now. Just, I've kind of switched up. I've gotten into the prop game the past couple years. So
well, there you go.
Kind of focusing on that right now. It's kind of a fun change of pace, get like a little more hands-on.
Yeah.
Kind of channel my inner James Cameron creativity.
There you go. Guillermo del Toro. He worked in prop shops.
Totally.
And all that.
So might go that route. We'll see. Stay tuned.
Well, very, very exciting. Well, I'll look forward to hearing more. Well, thank you so much for coming on in. Usually I tell people what's coming next, but coordination for schedules and recordings have been a little out of my realm of control based on availability. So I don't know what's coming next, but what I know is it's going to be a one-on-one with another guest, and it's going to be a favorite of theirs, and we're going to take the time to get to know them and get to know the film just in the same way we did today. And so be on the lookout for the next episode. Bryson, thank you again for coming in. And for those, thank you for joining I Know Movies and You Don't. That's with me, your host, Kyle Brule. And we'll see you later.